These days, everyone who has a mobile device can take great photos and shoot videos, showing up all the time on Flickr, Instagram, Facebook, and a host of other social media sites. You point your phone and shoot a picture. Sometimes it's a hit, and many times it's a miss. So what separates the amateurs from the pros? For over 125 years, Dodd Camera has assisted photographers, both professional and amateur, with state-of-the-art cameras, lenses, lighting and darkroom equipment, and class instruction. You can learn about new equipment from their blog or attend one of the many in-store events. The folks at Dodd Camera are helpful, professional, and experienced. They'll take the time to answer your questions and give you advice you can use. You may go to doddcamera.com to find out more. And finally, we wish to thank Dodd Camera for sponsoring the Outspoken Cyclist podcast.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for January 27th, 2018. I hope you had a chance to mosey on over to the healthiq.com website and take a look around. Maybe you even took the cycling quiz, or if you're a runner, the running quiz. The folks at HealthIQ have figured out that if you live a healthy lifestyle, they can partner with you to help lower your life insurance rates, sometimes by as much as 33%. When HealthIQ came to me to say they wanted to help support the show, I took the quiz and saw some interesting questions that not only made me glad that I take care of myself, but made me think about how. Take a moment to go online at healthiq.com/TOC. You can learn more about the organization. You can get a free quote to see if you qualify for lower rates on your life insurance. Don't forget to add that /TOC to the URL, healthiq.com/TOC. We get some points for that. So let's move on to this week's show. We have three great guests with some very interesting topics for you. On December 30th, 2017, The Washington Post ran a story about a 30-year-old triathlete named Danielle Mack. Written by Amanda Loudon and titled, "She was a triathlete in great shape, so why was she breathless, lightheaded, and in pain?" The story detailed the difficult and harrowing search for the issues Danielle was having, finally finding a specialist in Denver, Colorado. Dr. Todd Olin is a pediatric pulmonologist. He not only was able to diagnose the problem that Danielle and other athletes like her have, he has also developed a special breathing technique to control the symptoms. The disease is called EILO, exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction, and we'll be speaking with Dr. Olin about it in a few moments. My second guest is Bobby Sweeting from Alto Cycling. Bobby, along with his partner, Sean Gravois, have a deep background in both racing and engineering and saw a need for a more reliable carbon fiber wheel and rim. Acknowledging that aerodynamics is a big component of racing and riding, Alto Cycling also believes that a wheel should have lateral stiffness and good rolling resistance, responsiveness, and durability. In other words, they want you to go faster, more reliably. Bobby will be with me later in the show to tell us about the company and its products. My final guest this week is Sean Spencer. He is the event chair for the, ready for this, U.S. Open Fat Bike Beach Race Championships. So riding a fat tire bike is one thing, but slogging through beach sand on a fat tire bike for 1 or 2 hours, I think that might be something else altogether. It turns out this year marks the 4th annual Fat Tire Beach Race Championships, and we'll find out more about the event later on. So before we head on over to Denver to talk to Dr. Olin, I'd like to mention two items that came up this week in my news feeds. First, there's a great story written by journalist Kaylee Fretz for cyclingtips.com. I don't know how he gets to have all the fun, but Kaylee, his wife Meg, and their friends Chris and Christy took a vacation to Colombia. And along the way, Kaylee snapped photos and wrote and wrote and wrote. And he wrote a story titled The Road to Nairo's House. It's a travelogue that winds its way through Colombia, now more safe to ride and visit since the drug cartels were wiped out, to Nairo Quintana's house, where there's a virtual shrine to the cycling star. If you want a beautifully written and vivid look at the country, all by bike, of course, the story was published on January 24th at cyclingtips.com. My last item is something we haven't done in a long time, a video of the week. If you want a good laugh in a 26-second video, go to South Africa Live and look for the ostrich that outruns the cyclists at over 45 miles an hour. So as promised, it's off to Denver, Colorado, to have a conversation with Dr. Todd Olin from National Jewish Health. Hello, Todd Olin. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. So you are a pediatric pulmonologist at the National Jewish Health Hospital in Denver, but you don't just treat children. Tell us a little bit about your background, what you do, and what your practice is.
Perfect. Yeah, so I'm a clinician scientist, so that means I do both research and clinical work, and I focus mainly on problems that occur during exercise. That started out mainly focusing on shortness of breath, and it's expanded to include other conditions. But the work that I spend most of my time on really revolves around athletes that are getting short of breath when they're exercising.
I know most people would say, oh, they must have exercise-induced asthma, but there are other related diseases, I take it.
Yeah, absolutely. So asthma is probably the most common chronic respiratory condition that exists, and it probably affects on the order of 10% of the population, plus or minus a few percent. But there are absolutely other conditions. So exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction is a condition in which the throat closes during exercise. It used to be called vocal cord dysfunction because people had visualized the vocal cords narrowing, obstructing the airway during really high-intensity exercise.
But that's not what happens?
Oh, no, that's absolutely what happens. And so the vocal cords can narrow up. Additionally, there's other structures in the airway that can also in the area of the vocal cords that can also obstruct the airway.
How I found out about you was through the Washington Post article last December. You treated a young woman, I guess she's 30, who had just been to 8 different doctors, not figured out what was happening, and was having problems with the shortness of breath and pain in her legs and all kinds of other symptoms than just the breathing. And then she was diagnosed with EILO, this exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction. Who gets this? Is this a genetic malformation?
Yeah, this is a super question. And so sort of traditionally, and certainly the most common demographic of patients I'll see is an adolescent or young adult female, usually, you know, like age 15 to 25 would sort of be the probably most common age range. And the cause of it, sort of that, like, you know, the why behind that is unknown. We don't, it could be sort of the size of the airway or the flexibility of the airway or the sensitivity of the airway. There could be a lot of different things playing into why this demographic is most commonly affected, but we really don't entirely know. At the same time, despite the lack of really precise mechanistic information about why this diagnosis occurs, we can still treat it fairly effectively in a large number of individuals.
So one of the questions I have is why it took doctors so long to diagnose Danielle's issue. Was she seeing the wrong kind of medical practitioner, or is it a fairly obscure situation?
Right. No, it's a super question. So Certainly, it's not an obscure situation in that we think about 5% of adolescents and young adults struggle with it. So it's actually really common. What we're lacking, and the reason there's a lot of confusion, is that the words that we use to describe shortness of breath and the time that we have to really elicit the details around that in sort of the traditional 2018 medical setting are sometimes insufficient to characterize it ahead of time, to sort of lead doctors down that path. What made Danielle particularly tricky is that within that, you know, in the context of all that confusion, she wasn't a total slam dunk. There were sort of details of how she presented it made it a little bit extra tricky. Specifically, like some of these things outside of the shortness of breath were, I think, misleading to an extent.
Ah, I see. So is it preventable and is it curable?
Yeah, super question. So the prevention question in 2018, we don't know the answer to that. And in part because we don't know what causes it. We have a little bit of a sense of who is more likely to get it and who's not from an observational perspective. But no one's ever really truly tried to take a group of 1,000 people, give them a medicine or a treatment or an exercise or whatever, and then say, okay, in the next 5 years, who does or does not develop this? No one's ever done that. As far as the treatable, yes. So we've developed some newer breathing techniques at National Jewish Health and some new teaching methods which involve cameras that have been really effective for these patients. And for those patients that who have experienced this problem before, they themselves can prevent this from happening by using some of those teaching tools and breathing techniques to prevent problems from happening in the future.
Aha. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dr. Todd Olin. He is a pediatric pulmonologist at National Jewish Health Hospital in Denver, Colorado. And you have developed a sort of breathing technique that can be taught to these patients. How tricky is this technique? Because I know Danielle needed to come back to you a second time.
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I won't sugarcoat this. It's tricky. It's sort of like learning how to swim butterfly, where when you watch a video of Michael Phelps swimming butterfly, it looks really fluid and effortless and automatic. And when you try to get in the pool and swim butterfly, it is anything but fluid and automatic. The trick is to work with somebody, and I think in 20 years, a lot of people will be doing this. Right now, the trick is to work with someone that's really savvy at how to teach it, how to work from step one to step two to step three, to move you from I can't swim butterfly to I can swim butterfly, sort of in the analogous sense with this breathing technique. Or there's actually three separate ones that are all very closely related.
Are you training other doctors in this technique?
Yeah, so we're working on developing a course for that around the country in a few different places to try to explain it. There's nothing quite like sort of working with an individual for an extended period of time to learn sort of the fine points of certainly the speech and language pathologists who are our frontline breathing coaches here at National Jewish Health have all spent a lot of time with me to learn how to teach this and have contributed to perfecting it as well.
I wanted to ask what some of the hallmarks of the obstruction is. What are some of the hallmarks you look for when somebody is presenting to you with a breathing issue for this disease?
This is the most important question, and thank you for asking. So patients will be out of breath. That doesn't narrow things down much, but the breathing problem is often noisy, and it's frightening. And so the noise sounds sort of like this, where patients will seem to be gasping as they are running at really high intensity, kind of like it's something that they will often hear in their body. It's something that observers will pick up from a distance. Observers will and patients will also pick up on sometimes just the sheer terror of these events. They bother people. They make parents worried. They make coaches pull the patients off the field. Usually other breathing problems, even problems that cause the oxygen level to drop, don't cause that sort of fear. And sort of, I'm in Colorado, people climb mountains. When people are at the top of a 14,000-foot mountain, pretty much everyone's oxygen is a little bit low. but no one experiences fear. Everyone's just taking selfies when oxygen is low. Exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction or vocal cord dysfunction is really different. It is terrifying for a good portion of the patients.
So how long does this last? Somebody's out on a run at a high intensity, and this situation starts when they slow down. Does it go away?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the time course and the relationship can be helpful to diagnose it. So it usually comes on when people are out of their comfort zone. They're, you know, certainly like in an exercise lab setting, they're at like 95, 98% of what they can do. It's not on the junk mileage sorts of rides and runs that bring this on. It often goes away fairly quickly as patients back off with regard to intensity as well. So if they stop running or riding, it will usually go away within a few minutes. Certainly once people have started understanding their problem and started getting treated, the duration of an episode once intensity is lowered becomes really, really short. But the goal with treatment is to make it so that the events never happen or that patients don't have to slow down despite the fact that they might be starting to trigger an episode.
You know, it almost sounds like a panic disorder of a sort.
Right. So that's absolutely been observed. There's this chicken and egg problem in the sense that the throat tend to close up because people are physically or cognitively out of their comfort zone, or is it the other way around?
Right.
Where, you know, like sort of what's going on there is a little bit unclear. At the same time, it's actually a great observation to make because if you can use that to a therapeutic advantage, you can help patients get better to understand, you know, how they respond to stress or some of the thoughts they're having when things start to get difficult from a breathing perspective. If you can reframe those, sometimes you can use that observation of panic and fear to a therapeutic advantage. You can sort of attack two things at once, the breathing mechanic and the sort of approach to stress.
Once somebody learns the breathing technique, will it become sort of natural to them to be able to use it? So they get so used to it, comes on, they start that? Or do you use this technique to breathe right along?
Right. So great question. So I think of a couple different areas of teaching, probably similar to how a lot of athletes think about different sort of domains of their sport. One of those domains is just independent of the breathing mechanics, independent of managing the thoughts around performance or stress or, you know, all of sort of the cognitive things. There is absolutely this need to develop fluidity to the breathing and to make it automatic. And so a lot of what we do in the hospital is to work on that so that patients are able to essentially just shift into this technique whenever they feel like it without having to like warm up with it for 20 minutes. Essentially, like, if I can't make it automatic, I haven't done my job.
Got it. I see. Very interesting. Wow. This has been so fascinating. So other than this particular EILO, which, of course, if anybody's listening and is from the 80s and remembers ELO, this ain't it. are there other physical issues that you deal with, breathing issues that you deal with specifically with athletes besides EILO? Are there other breathings and asthma, obviously?
Yeah, well, so absolutely. So asthma is really common. And as you move up the ladder of higher and higher levels and higher performance, asthma becomes more and more common. And sort of in the endurance sport world, especially cold, dry air, you know, cross-country skiing, long track, speed skating, hockey, those sorts of things, asthma becomes really common. Almost 50% of international level skiers will have it. There's certainly other problems that are not as common as these two conditions that show up. So things that drop oxygen, for example, be it at the heart level or the lung level, they'll make it hard to exercise. And so part of my job is to be able to identify those things if they're occurring at the same time or in isolation. But the things that those other conditions are just much less common.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. And if we help one person who's experiencing this, it'll make me very, very happy because I know how it is when you just don't know what's going on and the fear takes over and then you stop exercising or you stop doing whatever it is you do.
Right. Well, and that's the public health risk behind all of this, because very few of us are going to be international level cyclists, but we want to be healthy as we move on through our 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s. And exercise is a huge part of that. Exercise is a huge part of people's identities. And my job is just to make people able to do what they want to do. And if one listener hears that noise, that noise, and says, wait, that's my thing, we can help that. We can cure that. And that's sort of my mission in life.
Can people contact you?
Absolutely. People do this, and people fly in from around the country. I think I've seen people from 46 states, which is kind of crazy. It's exercise at njhealth.org. So exercise at N as in national, J as in Jewish, health, H-E-A-L-T-H.org is a great way to get a hold of either me, or we have sort of a team of people working on this exercise intolerance program that can help anyone that calls, any age. If I'm not the right person, it's a pretty small world in the academic breathing problems world. I tend to know the right person if I think it's outside of my wheelhouse.
Well, I really appreciate you talking with me today. I know you've been running around, you said, sort of like a chicken, and I appreciate that you took this much time explaining this sort of obscure thing that goes on, but I'll bet there are people out there who are going to benefit from what we've talked about today. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for taking the time.
You too. Talk to you. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Dr. Todd Olin joined me from his office at National Jewish Health Hospital in Denver, Colorado. Dr. Olin is the director of Pediatric Exercise Tolerance Center. He's an associate professor. He's with the Department of Pediatrics and the Department of Pediatric Pulmonology at National Jewish Health. You can find out more about exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction at nationaljewish.org and go to Conditions, Exercise-Induced Laryngeal Obstruction, EILO. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to head on down to Florida to speak with Bobby Sweeting from Alto Cycling. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'd like to thank our new podcast sponsor, HealthIQ.com, for supporting The Outspoken Cyclist podcast. HealthIQ is an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like us. Runners, cyclists, triathletes, even vegetarians get lower rates on their life insurance. All you have to do is go to healthiq.com/TOC to support the show. See if you qualify for lower rates. They use science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance, and the savings are exclusive to HealthIQ clients. So log on to healthiq.com/TOC, support our show, see if you qualify.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and it's off to Sarasota, Florida for a chat with Alto Cycling's Bobby Sweeting. Hello, Bobby. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. So, you know, carbon fiber is the whole world these days. You seem to be in the right place at the right time. And so I want to know about you and about your company, Alto Cycling.
Yeah, I guess in a nutshell, just regarding how we got started, myself and Sean Gervois were college roommates at the University of Florida studying mechanical engineering and racing professionally for the past decade or so. And we would finish training rides and be told by various sponsors that the wheels would be improved, the handlebars, the frames, in all sorts of different ways. We would have our own issues in training and racing that a lot of our sponsors didn't seem to be focusing on. We didn't know why. You know, we didn't know from an industry standpoint whether it was timeline or price point or whatever it may be, but we thought that there was a lot of room for improvement. So when we graduated, I left and worked for CSG in the rigid frame department, mainly for Cannondale, and Sean stayed and got his master's at UF. And when he graduated and I left CSG to race full-time, we started talking about what would be the biggest impact to the end user? What product could we come out with that we could patent, that we could really make a difference in, and that we could find an investor to support so that we could do it in-house here in Sarasota? And so we focused on the wheel system, particularly the rear hub design, to better balance the spoke tension, to have a stiffer wheel, and particularly to eliminate brake rub. You know, one of the biggest issues we had as racers was being told that your wheels were more aerodynamic, standing up and accelerating out of a corner or in a sprint, and getting brake rub on your rim brake models. And that noise bothered me to no end. And we knew that it couldn't just be us that had this issue. And so in focusing on that to begin with, and then branching out into our composite work and our lacing patterns and all of the things that we do now, really stemmed from solving that one particular problem that we had as racers, and it's gone from there.
So do you think that the brake rub problem, the standing up and having the wheel shift from side to side, was more of a stiffness problem or a rim diameter problem? Well, I should say the depth of the rim or the weight of the rim. What did you come down to as figuring out? Because, you know, everybody's into aerodynamics, but everybody also wants faster and lighter. And carbon fiber has a failure, you know, rate that's fairly high, at least it has.
There were 8 different variables that we had to program into a computer program called MATLAB, and it came down to the laminate structure of the rim, the flange spacing of the hub, the flange diameter, the hole count. All of these different things play an important role in how much the rim and the tire moves side to side and how much energy you lose to lateral wheel deflection instead of being able to put all that power into the drivetrain. So we had to run it as an iterative computer program to figure out if you move the non-dry flange of the hub further out, you increase the bracing angle of the spoke, but you lose spoke tension. If you move it further in, you increase the spoke tension balance, but you have a narrower bracing angle. So what's the right answer? You know, it's somewhere in the middle, and it's essentially an optimization problem to figure out the correct answer to hub geometry and all the variables that go along with it, so that when you put 5 pounds of force laterally on the rim and you measure the deflection to have the least amount of deflection possible. And really what it results in is a wheel set that when you stand up and accelerate, not only does it not rub the brakes, it feels more responsive and snappier than any set out there. And that's really what it was designed for, to have better power transfer, better responsiveness is what it came down to.
You also, interestingly enough, not only make a carbon fiber rim, and I want to talk about your hubs and your quick release and a few other things, but you also make an aluminum rim.
Yeah, we work with Velocity on our aluminum rims. We use their mandrels, and we do a custom finishing process and custom drilling. Aluminum's a little bit different. You know, all of our metalworking is done in the U.S., and when we went to launch our A26 and our AX26 models, we thought, you know, we could create a specific mandrel and a specific cross section that we really like and do it ourselves in Sarasota, but it's going to look very similar to what else is out there. And you can't change the grain structure of the metal. So it really just comes down to cross section, hole drilling and finishing, shot peening, anodizing, that kind of thing. So being able to do a custom finishing process with Velocity has been awesome. And they're already making some of the best rims in the world here in the U.S. So that's been a great partnership. Our composite rims, we have to do ourselves, 100% proprietary, because you can manipulate the laminate structure and the ply orientation to be specific to your hubs. And that's really important, to be able to manipulate a composite to be specific to its load case scenario. With metal, it kind of is what it is. You don't have that much control over the way that it deflects. And so that's why we chose to work with a rim that already existed for our aluminum rims.
Got it. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Bobby Sweeting. He is one of the owners of Alto Cycling in Sarasota, Florida. They make carbon fiber and aluminum rims and wheels. Talk to us about your R-symmetric design. What is that?
Yeah, we have 2 design and utility patents on the hubs, particularly the rear hub. And the very first one was R-symmetry. And it's just a catchy name. We are not marketing people in any way as a company founded entirely by engineers. We probably lack most in the marketing department. But R-symmetry is our way of naming the rear hub geometry that we came up with from that initial MATLAB program. And it essentially stands for right symmetry. What it does is, with that increased flange diameter on the drive side of the rear hub, you know, you're trying to increase the bracing angle of those spokes as much as possible. You can't move the drive side flange further to the right because the cassette's in the way. And as cassettes have gone from 9-speed to 10-speed to 11-speed, it's pushed that drive side flange further and further in towards the center of the wheel and narrowed that spoke bracing angle. And it just has made the tension balance between the drive side spokes and the non-drive spokes really large. With our symmetry, by increasing the diameter of the flange, you're essentially pulling that spoke bracing angle out. So most hubs, you'll see about 3.8 or 3.9 degrees if it's a very, very wide set flange facing. And with our symmetry, you see 4.3 degrees. So it doesn't sound like a lot. By increasing it that extra half of a degree, you get about a 20% better tension balance and tension drop from the drive side to the non-drive side. And by engaging all of those spokes on the non-drive side of the wheel, you just get a much, much more structurally sound wheel once it's all built up.
How about your lacing patterns? Are they standard or are they special too?
Nope, nothing special there. It's a two-cross pattern on the rear and radial on the front for our rim brake, and then disc brake is two-cross on the front. So you can lace our hubs with any lacing pattern. Our rims are specific to those patterns simply because they're drilled in two directions. They're drilled for the spoke bracing angle, and they're drilled for the angle of the lacing pattern. So you couldn't take a rear CC52 wheel and lace it with a radial pattern, because the nipple would sit awkwardly in the spoke hole. So, but the hubs you can lace in any pattern.
Yeah, I got what you're saying. Whose free hub body goes on your wheel?
Everything with our hubs is all done here in Sarasota. So it's our free hub, all of our internals. We are EDMing all the poles here in town. So all of our hubs and all of our metalworking we do here. The free hub is the system is a 48 tooth internal ratchet ring that threads into the shell. And it's a 4-pole design with 3 individual teeth cut into each pole, so you actually have 12 points on the poles themselves instead of 3 or 4 like you see with most brands. So you get increased surface area, increased engagement, and less risk of failure because you have so much surface area engaged between the poles and the ratchet ring.
What is the range of cassette numbers? So can you do 9-speed, 10-speed, 11-speed, or is it just 11-speed?
Sure, it's an 11-speed free hub, but all you have to do is add a spacer. So if you want to run 10-speed, you put the 1.8-millimeter spacer on there prior to the cassette, and you can run your 10-speed or your 9-speed cassette. One of the coolest things that we do is we just launched our XDR free hub body for mountain bike in particular. But when we talked to the SRAM engineers last year at Interbike, they told us about XDR, the fact that it was a little bit wider spacing, really geared towards 12-speed and their Eagle cassette model. And so we created the XDR driver to their brand new geometry, but we made it compatible with all of our wheels, our road wheels, rim brake, and disc brake, because we have a slight inclination that they're going to be launching their 12-speed road group set very soon, maybe in the spring for the Classics is my guess, total guess. But once they do that, if you want to run like a 12-speed 1x SRAM system, you'll be able to put our XDR free hub onto our carbon clincher models. And it's already an option on our website. You can already buy it, even though it's not really a thing that exists yet. But we've had a handful of people buy it. Culture of Speed, one of our shops in Colorado, purchased a CC52 set for the XDR free hub, and they're just running it as a 1x system for like a crit setup. And that's pretty cool.
So what we need are more gears on the back. I know. I'm not going to go there. Right. That's right. Pretty soon
13,
it'll be just
14.
Ridiculous. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So what about the accommodation for SRAM, Shimano, Campy? Are you all across the board, or is anybody not going to be working on your wheel?
No, we make 3 different free hubs, our Shimano / SRAM standard free hub, our Campy free hub, and our XDR model. So,
man, I don't know how you got away with that. I think it's really cool, though. I love it.
It's tough. It's tough to really track down the drawings for the free hubs, working with Campy, working with Shimano to make sure the splines are oriented properly. Those aren't our designs, obviously, so we have to make sure that they're compatible with all of their products. And it's a process for sure, but they're really helpful. We talk at all the trade shows, and those guys are great. So, yeah, we were able to do it all. It's a lot of startup capital from an investment standpoint to be able to do it all yourself, but that's, I think, the only way to get into this industry is to make sure you have something really special to offer.
Once again, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Bobby Sweeting. He is Alto Cycling down in Sarasota, Florida. We're talking about his wheels. I want to talk to you a little bit about your quick release skewers, because when you order a pair of your wheels, you offer your skewers. Is there something different about them?
Nothing particularly different. Okay. They use a nylon cam, an external nylon cam. We do offer a race skewer with a brass cam that's a little bit more durable and a little bit lighter. It has a smaller throw on it, but the quick releases are one of those products where you only notice it if it doesn't function properly.
That is true.
Good to put it. And so as long as your quick releases aren't creaking, they're securing the wheel properly, it's one of those products that you shouldn't notice. Everything else about all our metalworking in terms of our symmetry, our axle system, our new carbon fiber work and our rims, those are all really performance-oriented products that you kind of have that wow factor with. The skewers are less about that and more about pure functionality.
Yeah, I'm into functionality when you want to try to keep your wheels on the bike. So I want to diverge a little bit from the technical part of what goes on at Alto Cycling and talk a little bit about the cyclist who is probably more my listener, the person who rides 3,000 to 6,000 miles a year and, you know, does club rides and might stick a rack on the back of his bike. What do you say to somebody like that who would like to ride carbon fiber wheels? Are they appropriate?
Right. You know, the coolest thing about carbon, and it harkens back to what we were saying about manipulating the laminate and the fibers themselves to be able to really tune the ride. So while it's a more performance-oriented product and it's stiffer and more responsive, the biggest thing that people notice is that it just smooths out the ride quality. It makes your bike much quieter and more comfortable on road vibration, on the trails if you're mountain biking, and it makes the whole experience more enjoyable. So it really runs a wide spectrum of athletes, because for the racer, they want it to be super stiff, snappy, out of the saddle, get up and go, more power transfer. But for 99% of people, they just say, man, the asymmetry of the hub, you can feel, not because I'm accelerating any faster, because I'm mostly seated and I only ride 15 miles an hour and I'm just a club rider, but none of that matters, because when you sit down and you push the pedal down and you go, that wider bracing angle just dampens all the vibration, all that noise kind of goes away, and you're just more comfortable on the bike, and it feels like you're riding on glass as opposed to on a road. And that goes for all carbon fiber. We obviously think that we do a few things a little bit differently than some other brands that accentuate those features, but going from aluminum to carbon, that's usually the biggest takeaway. Isn't the performance aspect, but the comfort aspect of the material itself.
So what about, well, of course, now you've got road discs, but yeah, braking is still probably better on carbon fiber with disc than it is with any of the rim brakes. You don't have an aluminum braking surface, do you? It's all carbon.
Yes. So we make a disc brake model. Our aluminum model is just an aluminum rim, obviously. We don't do any sort of carbon fairing with an alloy brake track. And one of the videos that we launched recently, gosh, it's probably been about 2 months now, we had been working for 8 months on two different products for 2018. One was a new resin for our rim brake models, as well as a filament winding operation. And the second was a high-pressure hookless disc brake model. So we did them simultaneously because we knew that there would be two camps. You know, that argument between rim brake and disc brake for carbon fiber wheels is a heated one, and it's probably split right down the middle, 50-50. And as a company, and I think most companies are seeing sales in both categories now for road. So we wanted to create a rim brake product that completely shattered the disc brake argument, and we wanted to create a disc brake product that completely shattered the rim brake argument. And what I mean by that is people who ride rim brake carbon say disc brake's not necessary, disc brake's heavier, disc brake's less aerodynamic. And so we've wanted to create a disc brake product that was as light or lighter than a rim brake product, as aerodynamic or more so than a rim brake product, and have it be hookless, useful with a standard tube as a clincher, or tubeless, all the way up to 110 PSI. So there's no sacrifices made. And we were the first rim manufacturer to accomplish that. And then on the rim brake side, the people who are on disc brakes, they say the rim brakes are dangerous. They could delaminate and fail. They don't break as well. And so we wanted to create our rim brake product with a new resin that made them completely impervious to heat and delamination with better braking power, more consistent braking. And by doing both, I think we reached both camps and people of both mindsets. For me personally, I ride rim brakes simply because they're easy to work on, and I'm an old curmudgeon-y bike racer. So part of that project was personal because I wanted to show people exactly how rim brakes from all different manufacturers. We tested 9 manufacturers in the test to see when they failed, how they failed, at what temperature, at what time, and that we created a product that essentially could not fail. Technically, it did after 40 minutes of braking, but realistically, you will never see a heat failure with our rim brake product. So I think we've really touched on both subjects with both of our new products for 2018.
I like what I'm hearing. That's awesome. It's awesome. So the last thing I want to talk about is your rental program, which I think is a really – oh, wait. No, I had one other question. What's the maximum width of a tire for your rims?
We actually made a chart for our disc brake rims because it's so chaotic.
Yeah, no kidding.
So many options. But without getting into too much detail, for our mountain bike rims, there are two widths. There's our standard boost width, which is a 30-millimeter external rim, and a Boost Plus model, which is 41 millimeters.
Okay.
So that ranges from 1.9 inches to 2.4 inches for our standard boost rim, which is kind of your cross-country and trail use, and then 2.4 inches up to 3.0 for our Boost Plus, which most people are running like a 2.6 or 2.8-inch tire on a hardtail mountain bike. For our hookless disc brake product, our CCX models, those have been our most popular disc brake models because they're used for road, for cyclocross, for gravel, and they're very, very versatile from a tire standpoint because you can put a 25-millimeter Continental GP4000 on there with a tube at 100 PSI and go use it as a road setup, or you can put a 45 or 50-millimeter gravel tire on there, set it up tubeless, and run it at 25 PSI. So it's an incredibly versatile wheel. It ranges from 25 millimeters up to 60 millimeters as far as tire size compatibility goes. And then our rim brake model, which is hooked, of course, has a 19.5-millimeter internal width and 26.5 external. You can go as far down to a 23-millimeter tire on them, but we don't recommend it. They're designed for a 25, and you can go up to 28 or even a 30 if you wanted to. But with that larger internal width, the tire will always measure out 2 millimeters more than what it's listed as. So when you put your 25 on there, it'll measure out to a 27. A 28 will measure out to a 30, that kind of thing. So 25 is really what they're designed for our rim brake product.
Cool. Got it. Okay, let's talk about your rental program. So I think this is a really cool idea. This is a great way to sell wheels, and that is once you get somebody to ride a pair, they don't want to give them back. So explain how your rental program works.
Yeah, that was kind of the idea.
Yeah, no kidding.
Going around to shops, going around to trade shows, it's kind of just a story until you get a chance to try it. Our whole brand, I think any brand, it's just a story until you can actually feel the difference. Unfortunately for us, the sales process for our retailers, it's pretty straightforward because they can bring in a single demo set at employee purchase pricing. And I'm like, just let people try it. As soon as people have the chance to go on a parking lot test and use their current wheels versus our wheels, they'll be sold right away. And you won't really have to say that much. If you hang them on the wall new and you try to sell our story versus Zip, Envy, and Mavic, it becomes harder because they've been around for much, much longer. So we saw how much the ride quality spoke for itself, and we're trying to think of a way to get people on them by any means necessary. And the rental program, while it's used for people who are just bringing in a disc wheel, like a CC86 front, disc wheel, rear, for their triathlon event and then shipping them back, we do see a handful of that, of those customers. But for the most part, they'll bring in that set or they'll bring in a CC52 set for an event for a grand fondo. But it's less about spending the $200 for the wheel set on the event so that they go faster. And it's more about, hey, I've seen these guys online. I've seen their testing videos. I've talked to my buddies about them. And I just want a super risk-free way to try them out. And I would say 99% of the time, the wheel set doesn't get rented more than once or twice before it ends up being sold, because we do knock off $100 from the sale price each time it's rented, and we send a card with the wheels. So by the third time they go out, you're saving $300 on the set minus your rental fee. So if the wheel set, if the CC40s are $2,000, you rent them for an event for $200, and you get the wheels, and it's the third time they've gone out, you have the option to buy them at $1,500 once you're done, and you keep the tires on, they're on your bike, ready to go, and you just leave them on the bike. And it's a really attractive option that's really low risk. So that was really the intent.
I think it's a great idea. Well, Bobby, this has been really informative. I love how you know your stuff. I think the last thing we need to do is tell our listeners how they can find out more about Alto Cycling. So give us your website, and then I'll let you get back to work.
Awesome. Yeah. You can check out altocycling.com. If you want to watch our testing videos, you can click on the technology page. There are a couple of our newest ones, including our rim brake test, on there. You can see the reviews that have been done on our news page. And if you go to our contact page, you can fill that out. If you have any questions at all, it comes straight to me. So shoot me a message if you have questions. And I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much, and appreciate your time and your expertise. It's very impressive, and I like what I'm hearing. Good luck with your selling season for 2018, and maybe we'll talk again.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right, Bobby. Bye-bye.
All right.
Bobby Sweeting joined me from his office at Alto Cycling. If you are interested in more information on the wheels, hubs, the rental program, anything about Alto, you can go to altocycling.com. Their website is incredibly comprehensive, and I think they've got some great ideas. Let's take another break, and when we come back, we'll talk about racing your fat tire bike on the beach. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Back, and it's off to Wrightsville, North Carolina to speak with Sean Spencer, who's the event chair for the 4th annual U.S. Open Fat Tire Beach Championship. Hi, Sean. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Great, Diane. Thanks for having us.
Well, you know, I get these unusual press releases, and this one sort of went, huh? And you are the event chair for the U.S. Open Fat Bike Beach Championship. So who knew there was such a thing? And yet this is the 4th year. Tell us a little bit about the event. And it also became sort of a top 20 festival and event by Southeast Tourism. So you guys are like in the big time now.
Yeah, we're excited about that designation this year. The event just started one day. I was riding my fat bike on the beach and thought about it. You know, if you got a couple of people together, it's always a race. And then having the ability to utilize the host resort here, the Blockade Runner, and build a race course effectively like a cyclocross, but for fat bikes. Thus, we came up with Fat Cross and kind of history from thereafter.
Wow. You even have people who are going to be coming back to defend their championships. So where does this event actually get held? I mean, obviously, it has to be a beach somewhere.
Yeah, this one, it's on Wrightsville Beach here in North Carolina on the East Coast, Southeast Coast. And we've just got a pretty neat setup where we have a resort or a hotel right on the edge of the beach. And so we can base kind of registration and stuff out of the hotel. And then the beach is really good to us in that they let us use small tractors, if you would, or whatever, just little bits of, and a lot of hand digging for shaping the course, and we come up with all kinds of fun obstacles and set it up. And it's a 1-mile lap, And this year we've gone to a timed format, so we have a 1 hour, 1.5 and 2 hour event format.
Okay, so what kind of obstacle? I mean, isn't sand enough of an obstacle? But no, we have to make it harder.
Absolutely. I mean, it's we want it to be challenging and fun because I see a growth in endurance sports. Personally, I've done marathons and then led to ultra marathons and, you know, half Ironmans lead to Ironmans. And so the whole, I'm watching the community and everybody, what's harder, more challenging. And so we fill sandbags and make like this minefield of sandbags, or we will dig trenches that are like the shape of a snake and you have to go through this trench or over. Our beer sponsor, which is Crank Arm Brewery, they give us empty kegs, and so you have to cross these kegs. This year, we think they're dredging on the beach, which is beach renourishment. So we think there could be a 3-foot pipe down the middle of the course we have to traverse.
Oh, that
we can.
That sounds really exciting. Maybe. Anyway,
exactly.
So, how many people will participate in the U.S. Open Fat Bike Beach Championship?
Well, we cap it at 100 racers.
Oh, okay.
Last year we had 98, I believe. So it's each year it's doubled in size. So we started out with maybe 20 racers, and everybody's kind of scratching their head and wondering what this was going to be like. And this year we're expecting to sell out the participant end of it. But it just turns into a really fun day on the beach, and the weather last year, it was 65 on Saturday, and it snowed that night. So the weather's always exciting to see what's going to happen.
Oh, wait, you're not in Cleveland, huh? Yeah, if you don't like the weather here, you just wait a minute. Let me remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Sean Spencer. He is the event chair for, ready for this, U.S. Open Fat Bike Beach Championship down in North Carolina. You are quoted as saying, we're seeing CrossFit and triathletes use fast bikes as an alternative method to stay in shape. Pedaling for miles on a fat bike in soft sand at the beach is exuberantly painful, which is an interesting phrase, exuberantly painful. It sounds less than delightful. Who won this event last year?
Last year, I believe, I think Zoe Warshaw was a female winner, and frankly, I can't remember the male winner. And we've had 3 different male winners and 2 different female winners over the years.
Wow. How old are these people?
That's an interesting fact as well. I mean, the average age at this point in registration with the number of people we have is probably 46. So it's an older demographic for sure. I'm not exactly sure why, but I've got some ideas as to why.
Well, what do you think?
As with the whole industry, I think it's an aging demographic. I've been in the industry myself for 30 years, and it's interesting to look and, you know, the 20-somethings, at least in our area, aren't quite there. You know, the triathlons have backed off a little. There's other things that are taking people's energy and time. And this, however, is putting a little bit of spice back into sales in our area, fat bike sales. I think we're like the largest dealer for Specialized in the Southeast, which is interesting, but it all stems around location, and developing this event is what helps us sell bicycles when people see that you can, not necessarily that they race, but just that you can ride these bicycles everywhere.
Well, they are an unusual bicycle, and I thought the novelty would wear off, but it looks like maybe it's growing as opposed to shrinking. So, besides the main event for this race, which appears to be this 2-hour Saturday race, what other options are there for people who, I mean, I guess everybody who's signed up, these 98 people, are expecting to ride in either the 1 hour or 2 hour, right?
We do, yeah. So Friday we have a kind of like a tech talk, an adventure cycling briefing that night before at the resort, and then Saturday we're having a skid contest. There'll be some free riding of the course. Everybody, you know, it's fun to just go ride, and then Sunday morning we're going to do a ride on the whole island, and the beach itself is 8 miles long, so you can go get a fun 16-mile ride in the day after. If things come together, we've got a deserted island south of us
and a pontoon boat that we can get to. So you go to that island, and it's 8 miles, and there's not a soul over there. So that's always a fun adventure as well.
You should do a scavenger hunt over there. That sounds like fun.
That's a great idea.
A fat bike scavenger event. How much fun would that be?
So, maybe we'll do that someday.
Okay, there you go. So not everybody's ridden a fat bike. Are you going to have equipment there that people can try so that even if they don't want to compete, so that they can find out if they want to get a fat bike and maybe compete next time?
We will. We do. We've got a few that we have in our rental fleet. And the fun thing about the sport that we're seeing is it's kind of like old mountain bike days when you would go and everybody was happy and it's a fun, festive type atmosphere. So people are more than happy most of the time to share their own bike. Like, yeah, go take it for a spin. Check it out. You know, whereas if I go to a crit or some other type of event, sometimes people aren't exactly as sharing of their toys.
Yeah, you think? That's mine. Keep your hands off of that. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Sean Spencer. He is the chair for the U.S. Fat Bike Beach Championship. It will be held, what is the date?
St. Patrick's Day, so it's March 17th this year.
So that means you can have green beer. That's what we do up
green
here in Cleveland.
Everything this year.
Yeah, right.
Sure.
That's going to be fun. So if it isn't Fat Bike Championship weekend, can you actually ride your fat bike on the beach at other times? Do they allow that?
So yes, here locally, and I haven't heard of too many places where it's become an issue, but we've got rules kind of that we've set out and just put out in cyber world to you know, if you're on your fat bike on the beach, you super respectful of other people, wildlife, vegetation, all that kind of stuff, such that there isn't an issue. We're trying to stay ahead of that because we see it growing. And as with any public place, you just have to be mindful of other people on the beach and don't be going 20 miles per hour past someone who's watching the sunrise.
Yeah,
go behind them. Don't go between them and the water.
You mean don't be a jerk, right?
Exactly.
I mean, we can say that on this show. We could say other things too, but some of it's broadcast, some of it's podcast, so we have to be careful. So tell us a little bit about the Wrightsville Beach Foundation. I know it is the beneficiary of this event. And what is the foundation and what will they get from this race?
So we make a monetary donation to the foundation once we wrap up all of our stuff. And the Wrightsville Beach Foundation is a group from the community that has come together, and they will use different fundraisers and money and go out and help with the parks department. So they'll, you know, be at benches or just beautification of the island and the areas, the natural areas that people have to recreate on the island itself. So it's a good cause, and they do good stuff for the area.
So the last thing I really want to talk about is what you do. You are the event chair. You own a bike shop? Is that what I'm understanding here?
Yeah, I own Bike Cycles, bicycle shop here. I started it 12 years ago in Wilmington, and I've lived here my whole life. So when it came to when these bikes were first introduced a few years ago, I was up in the mountains and got to ride one, and I thought, man, this would be really neat on the coast. And so subsequently have figured out how to – I'll take a pack raft, for instance. Alpaca makes a great pack raft, and go out on these adventures where we can go ride 60 miles and cross from island to island with the pack raft, and you know, you can spend the night. And it's just there's adventures to be had that weren't available in the past. In the past, we would run these islands and make it an ultra marathon, and then the bikes came out, and it was like, wow, we can use these bikes and go further. So it's turned into a really neat avenue for an income stream and then recreation.
So wait, it's you actually ride this bike up onto a raft, or you wheel it onto a raft and then paddle that raft to an island?
So yeah, so we have our Outer Banks, so they're sand islands up and down the coast, and the inlets, it's about a quarter mile across a lot of the inlets. I think there's 7 inlets right here close to us, and the raft is inflatable, and it'll fit on your handlebars, and like a 3-piece paddle, and you You get up to the inlet and you deploy the raft. So you inflate it with imagine a big trash bag with a valve in the bottom, and you scoop air and like bellows, and you fill the raft up, and you lay your bike on the front of the raft and strap it down and paddle across to the next island, and put it back in the bag and take off down that island. And then you get to the next inlet and repeat and rinse and keep going. So it's a, eventually it too may become some type of event that is timed. But for now,
I think it sounds like a lot of fun.
It's different. It's definitely different. They're doing it a lot out west where they have rivers they can jump in and end up somewhere different. We just go island to island.
Yeah, that sounds okay. I hope there's food in there too somewhere. There's got to be food, right?
There's some great piers that go out, like fishing piers that have some unbelievable hot dogs and hamburgers and all kinds of
See, I knew
stuff.
Food had to be involved. Well, Sean, this has been delightful to talk to you about the U.S. Open Fat Bike Beach Championship. Once again, it is March 17th. It's at Wrightsville Beach in Wrightsville,
North Carolina.
And so how can people find out more information? Do you have a website they can go to?
The website's probably the easiest, and it's just fatcross.com.
Very cool. Well, lots of luck both with the event and the weather and with your shop this year. Good selling.
Thank you very much, Diane, and we listen to your podcast, so I appreciate it, and it's been an honor to be on.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that you listen. You have a great day, and maybe we'll come down one day and watch your Fat Bike Beach Championships. That would be so much fun.
Come on down, drink a beer, and check it out.
All right. Thanks. You have a great day.
You too.
All righty. Bye-bye. Sean Spencer joined me from his bike shop down in Wrightsville, North Carolina. Racing a fat tire bike in the sand. It's evidently great training, and it sounds like it's great fun. So that's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed all the guests. A big thanks to Dr. Todd Olin, to Bobby Sweeting, and to Sean Spencer for joining me today. We will be back next week with a peek at the 2018 NAB show coming up in a couple of weeks when we chat with show director Don Walker. Till then, I hope you stay safe, and if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.